So collision-free scheduling, dream or reality, and the panel after this is going to be random access scheduling, dream or reality. So wireless networks, dream or reality. Just a few thoughts. I mean, I prepared a few slides. I don't, and I'm mainly just talking points. Definitely not talking about any of my work or related work. Just thoughts about what collision-free scheduling may entail, and touching upon some of the issues. First of all, what do we mean by collision-free scheduling? Is the protocol that Jean talked about, is that collision-free scheduling, or do we consider that contention-based, given that we still have to contend for the mini-slot, at least initially? So what do we mean by that? Another point that I want to talk about is what is the impact of the physical layer, and particularly some emerging physical layer models, and how would they impact scheduling in general? And then just wrap up with a few issues on collision-free scheduling and random access approaches and so on. So I don't want to take long, but I want to the first thing that kind of struck me, and anything that's around here, and I guess it's sort of showing my age a little bit, one thing that first struck me was that actually, if you look historically, the early work on wireless data networks focused on random access, and the stuff in the 70s, the CSMA and the Aurora and all of those inventions. But if you look at the first radios, the wireless radios that were being deployed, primarily by the military, starting in the late 70s and in the 80s, there were systems like the E-Plus systems, the Singular system. I presume many of us are not familiar with these, but I had worked at Lincoln Laboratory for a good 6 years, became familiar with some of these systems. These were all TDMA-based. They were not collision-based. They were not Aloha. So people, you know, we studied Aloha, we were all excited about it, but people implemented these collision-free scheduling. I may not be answering the panelists' question with respect to the optimization problem that some of us have formulated, but nonetheless, the question was collision-free scheduling, and the answer is an old reality. It's been there. Now, even if you look at commercial stuff, a lot of the commercial stuff that's out there is collision-free. You know, a lot of the cellular data services are not based on random access, if I understand them correctly. Now, I guess the impetus to this question, putting the collision-free scheduling in question mark, really comes out from the fact that the dominant technology that we all use on our laptops for free is really 802.11, and so to the extent that that's a collision protocol.
So wait, Adrian,
yeah.
Just to be provocative, are you implying that CDMA is collision-free?
Well, that's my next, okay, good question. So what do we mean by collision-free? Is CDMA collision-free? So
what's your opinion?
Well, my opinion is that there is no answer. If you look at the last bullet of my slide, it's exactly answering Gobi's question. Simple collision or collision-free models were very, very nice guiding principles. But in reality, the physical layer model is not that simple. So let me go through that. But I think the answer is that there is no such thing as collision or collision-free. That's really the answer. I think that's what you're going after probably also. But we'll see.
I think there is a somewhat definition, because you assign different dimensions of the channel. So you assign a code. It might not be orthogonal, but it's not that there is no physical concept of what it means to assign different dimensions to users. So a collision is intended in the sense that you do not assign exactly the same dimension. You have a waveform which is not exactly align equal.
But even then, you're right, but even when we talk about collision, we don't necessarily mean, but let's leave that for a second, and we'll open it up. I'll just wrap up real quickly here.
I think, you know, we should pursue it.
Okay, we're going to pursue it right now?
How many users can you resolve? I think that's a...
Well, so if you're going to go pursue it, then... Well, if you're going to pursue it, then it's really talking about the physical layer model now.
Okay, so I can be quiet and we can talk about this tomorrow.
No, we agreed, right? We agreed we're going to discuss this. So let's discuss it. But now we're really talking about the physical layer model. And we have interference in the physical layer model. And the question is, what kind of detectors do we have? What is the receiver structure? So what do we mean by collision, right? Collision is probably the simplest receiver structure that I can think of, right? So I'm not sure, is that...
Well, why don't we let the other panelists weigh in?
Yeah. Anyway? I have a slide on it, so I will actually weigh in. That's why I can use it.
Continue with what you have in mind, and we'll get back to this anyway.
Okay,
everybody's going to talk about it. Yeah, but let's discuss it maybe at the end of when everybody has gone.
Can I add one more thing? I mean, you need to distinguish also between kind of licensed versus unlicensed spectrum, right? If you're an unlicensed spectrum, you saw the things you had up there were in license spectrum or dedicated spectrum, and so it's a lot easier to do collision-free stuff in that environment. So,
it's a good point. It's a valid point, yeah. So what do we mean by collision-free? I think that's really the point that we're all trying to go after, that in reality, interference is a soft notion. So what do we mean by that? I mean, you can adapt power, you can adapt the data rate, you can adapt the code to deal with interference. So really, I'm not so sure that there's such a thing as a collision, per se. At the same time, I'm not sure that there's such a thing as collision-free, per se. So we really need to consider more sophisticated physical layer models, is the point that I wanted to leave.
Yes, availability is a change at another word for collision, because if you've been in a hotel in a conference and you try to get your computer on, you know what collision is, I know.
Okay, I agree, that's another issue, and I leave that for another panel, perhaps, that availability is also.
You may say, I do not know what collision is, but you do understand availability.
Well, but that's a very different question, John. The question, John is raising an issue of availability. And in other words, if we all try to, you know, checking email right now, and suddenly you can see that there is. But that would also be the case if we had a complete orthogonal coding scheme.
Sure, but here the availability that we actually caught a cheater on exactly on the MAC protocol by knowing how you can cheat. And when everybody was saying that 40 people were supposed to line up and we were only 5 could access, it was abusing, right? The collision system, the collision avoidance that protocol was employing. So that was the non-availability was coming directly out of playing with collisions.
But you could achieve that presumably even if you had some kind of a TDMA coding scheme and somebody did not use their slots or use somebody else's slots or jammed you or whatever they wanted to do, right?
No, because if I had other things where I could schedule things carefully, then it would be a lot easier to achieve the capacity that was predicated without the randomness. The randomness cuts both ways. It allows you to avoid it, but it also causes it.
Good point. Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, there will be a panel on randomness next, right? So I'm not trying to stop the discussion here, but I'm noting that we are dealing really with this topic for the 2-day workshop in very many different angles, right? And I don't want to take all of the time in my discussion. So we're talking about physical layer models, and I have a feeling we're going to break into a long discussion of the impact of physical layer models when we look at the SANR-based models that give us more of a soft notion of a link, allow us to have power and rate control so that you're not necessarily on or off. Sophisticated multi-user decoding can deal with interference effectively. And the point that I make in the third bullet about multi-channel and multi-radio capability is actually saying that once you move into this multi-channel environment that we may be moving toward, then I'm not so sure what the alternative is to collision-free scheduling. In other words, I'm not sure what all random access we have in that context. I think the message is that, of course, we have to consider more sophisticated physical layer models, but also as we move toward more sophisticated physical layer models that enhance our capacity and so on, the cost of scheduling would seem perhaps small relative to the gains and also relative to what we're doing anywhere at the physical layer. I kind of want to finish talking, but maybe a slide on collision, and not because I'm not interested in the talk, just because I don't want to take the stage. Maybe a slide on collision-free scheduling and some of the issues in collision-free scheduling. It was alluded to the fact that by collision-free scheduling, what we really mean, or the organizers meant, was a TDMA-based system, and some of the optimization frameworks that stand out of Cassiulis' work in the early 90s, or Hayek and Sasaki on rate-based scheduling, and so on, that those optimization problems are very complex, sometimes NP-complete, not practical, and we have to approximate, and that may be so. But I think there are even more sophisticated, more difficult issues than just how to solve an optimization problem, because we don't have to solve that optimization problem per se. These are more maybe theoretical questions than practical questions. But what does it mean for two links to be non-interfering? Back to the physical layer again. What do we really mean when Tassiulis writes about non-interfering activation sets? How do we determine which links are non-interfering? I mean, how do we figure that out?
actually, in the original paper, this is completely
abstracted away.
Abstracted is a nice word. It was just swept away from the problem.
Lavos is a nice guy, so we use nice words.
You're a good friend, but that's.
Of course. It was abstracted away, but you know, John, the community has not moved dramatically beyond that. So, you know, many of us feel that.
That's true about all subsequent authors on the subject.
That's right. Most, right? All right. Okay, so I think I'm kind of done. Yes, and I think I'll let the other panelists weigh in on this topic.
I have a question.
Yes.
On your historical note, in working on what
so I think that, and John may be able to want to help out here too.
Well,
historically, let me try to answer. The question is historically.
I'm the oldest guy in the room, right?
And I'm probably the second or something. So the question is historically. Not quite, but maybe there are not quite, but nevertheless.
So, but what is the question?
Sorry. The question was about the historical, and why was it that people did not go with collision-based schemes?
Why did the military go?
Yeah.
Well, the military tried some of the collision-based systems, and again, I'm pointing at John because John has also worked with the military quite a lot. But in the original days, they tried to implement packet radio, and there were some implementations that were not very successful of packet radio systems, right? I forget the name of the company that was doing this, not Harris, but another New York-based company. Anybody remember?
Asselkin.
Say again. Asselkin. Yes. And they implemented this packet radio, and it was not terribly effective as far as I remember. And that was, I think, random access. And they moved away from that, and I let other people barge in.
So more likely, because they were doing voice, right? They weren't.
Well, the military usually has networks that they are not very large in scale, right? And they are very hierarchical and very well controlled. So under those circumstances, you cannot beat it yet, or time or schedule. So why? I mean, you don't have the problem with having when you go to large networks where access is random and so on and so forth. In the military, when you have a mission, you know exactly more or less when communications are going to occur. You can schedule them. You may have variations, but it's much more rigid to do it that way. And also the worry about I'm in a critical situation. I need to have a channel. I'm not going to allow randomly to get. This is what they worry about. And even today.
That's right. Even today, and I'll tell you, what you're saying is absolutely correct of the three systems that I put up there. There were small-scale systems that you could set up somewhat statically. But they did try, I think Heseltine you mentioned, and they didn't succeed.
Well, I just wanted to add to note that even today, there are wireless sensor network companies putting these things in industrial settings where they want control and reliability about exactly when these messages get from point A to point B. Also a place to use.
Probably if they tried it on voice traffic, it didn't make much sense to try the packet approach at that time.
I don't think they were that naive at that time to try the Aloha-based systems for voice traffic. They were probably...
And also the physical layers were actually much less... the throughput of the physical layer was much lower. So at the time, the all random access idea relies on the fact that you have more capacity than you actually need. If you operate in a very restrictive environment, it doesn't work.
And that's an important point, because wireless is not an environment where excess capacity. So
we don't. But the other, if you want to model this thing mathematically, a probably good way to go is to actually try to have some cost about the availability. So in the army, for instance, the cost for non-available because of what is problems is huge. Another area which is in the civil area, where you have the same problems, is satellite applications, where the bandwidth is very expensive. And there, if you see what happened, they did not go a lot with random access, despite Abramson's and all these ideas. They actually did much more TDMA kind of thing, because lost bandwidth there because of collision was very, very expensive. So that this cost actually played a big role about whether you will allow this because random access will lead you to losses.
In a lot of these commercial systems, I cannot think of many that they went with eventually an Aloha random access type scheme. Random access might have been used for control in the same way. Or some of like the Army type system, I believe, uses random access. Millions of users that send one packet a day.
And more than you can imagine, if you really work with practical companies practically and understand what is behind the the system, which they won't tell you. Quite a lot of the wireless companies, of course, use, you know, mini slots and scheduling and stuff like that. Right? They don't really do, you know, completely random access. There are tricks they won't tell you, because, of course, that's their edge.
Well, I think if we go back to the motivation for random access, it's when you have a large number of users that are active sporadically, then it does not make sense to do TDM.
Right.
If you have a link, like a satellite link that is used 98% of the time, then you should go to TDM. Right?
And if large part of your transmission are more or less the timing of them is scheduled or marked, right, or controllable, right? You're absolutely right. In the environment of why random access came, it was unpredictable user behavior, large number of users, and I have limited capacity was the most efficient use. And I can almost think of a way of proving that the best way to do it is this random algorithm, right? But if you have the other situation, where you have very rigid transmissions, more or less known, the largest portion of the traffic is very well structured in terms of time, then scheduling is the answer, and you can do it. Okay,
I don't know because I feel like all my answers are gone.
Let's go with the panel.
So the panel has to show us that it's actually a reality.
So I'm going to be just actually quite vague, but I think I will touch upon exactly the same questions I will raise. So the first thing I would like the question to raise is really who's doing. We are talking about when we talk about collision-free access, because if you think about information theorists, they have been managing interference rather than avoiding it. And in fact, we know information theoretically, and this is a curve very typical if you open any wireless communication book these days, you will see that if you actually manage interference constructively via multi-user detections that are more complicated and with some level of synchronization and coherent detection, you can actually beat any sort of collision-free or orthogonalized scheme per se, in the sense that the total rate that will be achieved will be larger than the sum of individual rates had you been giving collision-free access to the same channel to the users. So what I would like to talk about is when is it meaningful to actually think about this dream at all? And I would want to touch upon the issue raised earlier, which is this is really an issue of who controls the channel. What are the reasonable assumptions about how cohesive the network is? If you have a control of all the users in the network, you obviously have an interest in managing interference in much more constructive ways. When you go to uncontrolled spectrum, when you have many users, and it's not reasonable to imagine that you will want to understand the synchronization patterns among these users, then it makes sense to talk about, let's just do the best we can, which is go for a collision-free world. So that's the first point I would like to point. So now, then, why is that at all a fantasy to have a collision-free system? And this is touching back upon what John Wood talked in his talk, and also later on elaborated on. So, are any collision-free scheduler really good? I mean, that's a really important question to ask. And I think from John's talk and many other theoretical work, we know with fairly minimal overhead, we can achieve the throughput loss that random access can cause. But I'm not sure if, in the sense of delay, we are as successful. In the sense that, you know, if I find a way to find a consensus of who talks in a distributed way, which is exactly what John's scheme does, then I am actually happy gaining back almost all the throughput that I had lost in a collision-based system, but the delay will be this idle slots that I'm going to assume people have something to say and they don't, and the width of that slot is the holy grail of how much time I will waste imagining somebody is going to talk or not. So that is the question I would like to ask, is that in situations when you have sporadic large number of users, where you're interested in delay rather than throughput, then sometimes going for too simplistic collision-free systems actually give you a floor of large delay to start with.
So all of these systems, if you look at high load regimes, will give you an infinite improvement over a collision-based system because you have increased the throughput. But when you look at low traffic regimes that, you know, a lot of the system end up working in, then you are just creating an increase in sort of the base of delay the system will see. And so what you're really interested in finding an adaptive scheme which fills the empty slots fast enough and uses some sort of control channel to actually fill those. And then the question would be, what is this control channel's cost? And I will end with that and say, if I really think about a reality of thinking about what to do with this dynamic allocation and what is the cost, one of the dreams I have is to sort of go back and understand the minimum information that is needed to achieve enough information about the sporadic use of the channel. So if there is any randomness in my traffic pattern and I have sporadic use, I have to reconfigure constantly to fill the idle slots. What is the cost associated with that? For example, I know when the traffic is high, no matter how sporadic my traffic pattern is, we're all going to backlog, and our utilization will more or less look smooth. So in that sense, I might actually come up with a TDM scheme that converges to some slotting, and then all of us go in a TDM fashion with the delay behavior. But again, when I go back to the sporadic schemes, I'm interested to look back at Gallagher's 1970 paper on actually measuring the sort of information theoretically, what is the protocol overhead that we're introducing, since we need to sort of measure queuing delay and so on. And this actually, if this is the right way to think about what is the cost of the scheduler, then it will be a nice sort of link to Barry's work in terms of what these centralized schemes look at the channel, create a common randomness, which is the multi-user person, and create a common randomness to create the consensus faster. So there are all sorts of connections there that then we can exploit if we understand what is the sheer, sort of basic limit and reconfigure it.
I just want to make a comment about this. I mean, there is also, looking at the problem from the physical layer perspective, there is a big area that has not been explored as much as it should, which is that of protocol overhead, how much it costs to obtain those curves or the management of interference.
Exactly.
That you mentioned before.
So what I'm really interested in is a question that John posed to Jean, which is if I have
what John?
Leave them a figures.
which is if I want to reconfigure, figure out, basically work really functional CSMA, what is the overhead associated with understanding who wants to talk, right? Eventually, we need to understand who wants to talk, what is the need to talk, if you think about max weight scheduling, who has waited the longest, and so.
But I just
wanted
to recognize there is this work by Gallagher, and there is work on protocol overhead and figuring that out, various layers. I just wonder why this is not the problem everybody went after. There is something unappealing.
It's very difficult.
I think this actually will be addressed in a later panel that talks about what constitutes a useful theory result.
Yeah.
I mean, the paper, for example, is a beautiful paper, and that I've read recently, and actually working on this related topic now. But I'm not convinced yet that the results that I'm going to get and what I'm doing now really constitute a useful theory result. They make the elegant work, but I'm not convinced that it's necessarily useful.
But I mean, the question that I posed is the one I already wrote down to ask her, but she jumped ahead of me, which is good. I think it's very essential, okay, to understand this problem as a feedback control system, in the sense that a lot of the bandwidth that you have actually is not used. So you need to observe and understand how much is not used and try to reuse it. That is becoming easier by the day because of new physical layer technologies, I claim, right? And for instance, again, I give you an example of satellites. This will work a lot in satellites. There, because again, it's very expensive and they cannot afford to have unused bandwidth, they do very, very explicit schemes of determining who is using the bandwidth, who is not using it. Does anybody know what kind of figure they use when they try to dimension with a red network? What percentage of the total user? The question is, what percentage of total users that you have here, 1,000? How many they assume that they're actively used every 10 minutes for the purposes of dimension calculations? Of course, you understand, you miscalculated by 5% means really hundreds of millions of dollars in the case. So does anybody know what the figure they use? And when you go to a VC to try to make an argument, you have a, it's 12% to 10%. So mainly that you spend 12% on these calculations for dimensioning, of what percentage of your active users, of your other users will be active in any period of 10 minutes? And that is over all type of traffic.
But the type of traffic there is drastically different.
I'll come to this. No. I'll come to this. The other question I have that I want to address to all of you is that, yeah, there's an impact of physical labor, but there's also an impact of the mixture of traffic that you're talking about. So if you start having video and data and voice, many of the examples you mentioned from the army and so on and so forth was for voice traffic.
Actually, to be clear about that, that's
when we get to data and video and stuff like that, things change. Now, it's, again, there's an easy technological answer and there's a complicated one to analytical, right? The easy technological answer is you carry the header, right? A simple beat that tells you what kind of string, what kind of traffic flow you have. If it's data, actually you can tell whether you have large data stream or small data stream and so on and so forth. This avoids some of the problems of elephant versus mice that you and I know about, okay, and so on and so forth. But it also helps you a lot with respect to voice, because one question in the early 85 from all telecom companies was, how am I going to handle convergence? You know what they were worried about? I sell telephone lines, right? And now John and Zan and Juan and so on and so forth, they buy the telephone line, but they don't use it for phone service. So forget their line model, right? They plug it in and they do that. I'm dead, right? Because the availability of the line on a circuit-based system is humongous, okay? So AT&T, Bell Labs, those days, Telcordia, they were all getting multi-million contracts to study convergence in this regard. So traffic type has a very big role in addition to the physical.
I think I want to continue with the panelists, and we should, if you don't mind, I would like to continue to hear from the panelists, and the order would be Mac first and then PC. So,
thank
you. He's connected already. Oh, you already planned it. Let the PC guys sign.
Okay, so. As everybody said, we have to coordinate somehow the access to the channel. It's not only the timing, it's also the power, the rate, and other factors. We can do it, we not want to do it in a distributed manner, and we can do random access or collision. It's interesting that the wireline world, we moved from random access to collision free a few years ago when we moved from CSMA CD to some cable that runs to a box at the end of the corridor. Now the question is, can this be done in the wireless world? If yes, what will we gain in terms of throughput, delay, fairness, other measures? And again, back to the overhead, how much will this cost us? So this is my first random access system. Used it in the winter of 1990, pre-Cold War. It was called Army Navy Portable Radio Communication System. It suffered from collision, interference, and we suffered from back pain. So nowadays things are a little bit more relaxed. This is our current random access system. It is a iRoomba vacuum cleaner, okay, which is 802.11. Again, suffers from collision and interference, but at least can clean our problems. So again, so along the way, we learned that in a wireless network, we don't really have a predetermined topology. We cannot say these are links, these are neighbors, and even those disks that we've been using to model the transmission range are not really disks. Now, this is correct in several systems, but I want to go over a few of the possible systems that we see today. In the lower left corner, we see the short-range, low data rate personal area networks, such as ZigBee, sensor networks, and Bluetooth. In the right-hand side, we see the personal area networks, which are based or should be based on UWB, which are either WayMedia or UWB Forum. And it's interesting, in UWB, you cannot really, or some of those systems, you cannot really do carrier sense because there is no carrier. So the question becomes a little bit different. We know 802.11, and at the top we see 802.16, WiMAX, or future cellular systems. Now, most of our experimental results are either 802.11 or some kind of sensor networks, which are all random access systems. We don't get, I just heard that we will get to play with 802.16, but most of us don't have an 802.16 or WiMAX testbed in our lab, And therefore, most of our intuition or experimental intuition comes from 802.11 or some kind of sensors and so on. So we have to keep this in mind when we think about reality. Now, as everybody has said around here, there are also military systems that are out there. We know about some of them, we don't know about some of them, but they don't necessarily follow those IEEE standards. I want to briefly go over some of the systems that are more or less collision-free. One of them is 802.16 or WiMAX in the mesh component. Let's assume we deploy WiMAX in some rural area, we don't have fiber optics. We want to connect the base stations to each other wirelessly. If you look at the standard, there is a mesh way of doing that, and in that mesh way, we have to consider our neighbors and our two hop neighbors and to somehow coordinate the operations along within these neighbors. So we are back to the concept of neighbors, links, and so on, and some kind of a collision-free scheduling or coordination mechanism. Another system which theoretically should operate over UWB is called WayMedia or WayMedia Alliance. Initially, they defined a PConnect, which is composed of a controller and devices, and somehow the controller controls the devices. Nowadays, it's fully distributed. The timing is based on a super frame. At the beginning, there is a beacon, and there is a contention access period, and there is a TDMA period. So they do both, and you can play with both sides. A contention access period, strangely enough, is called CSMACA, although they say it's a preamble-based contention access. You really have to listen to the packet in order to know that there is packet, because you cannot sense UWB. The reserve slots are more or less, in the past, were allocated by the coordinator, and as I said, there is a fully distributed version that they don't want to mess with anything. The last issue, as Ethan already mentioned, are military systems. One of the systems that is being developed by the DoD is called JTRS, a Joint Tactical Value System, and other systems are being developed around the world by governments, defense agencies, and so on. They are mostly based on software-defined radio, and the reason for using software-defined radio is that there is no one-size-fits-all solution, as everybody already said. A MANE between fighter pilots has different capabilities and requirements from a MANE between infantry soldiers walking around. Therefore, there are many waveforms, and as much as I know, some of those waveforms will be collision-free, some of them will be random access, and that's more or less reality. Yeah. So, to conclude this short part, collision, both of them have been around for decades. Different systems need different approaches, and I believe we'll keep seeing both. There is one more factor that is somehow driving the type of research that we are doing, and this is our concentration on theory versus practice. And in general, there is always some kind of tension between the need to obtain fundamental understanding of those systems and the need to provide some practical solutions to real-world problems. And we divide our world to collision-free and random access, it's easier to be rigorous and provide tractable results when we make the collision-free assumption. The world is very complicated. When we distribute the algorithms, there are random arrivals. We need to learn about the delay and the throughput and the interaction and so on. At least if we assume the world is collision-free, it's easier. Now, we also tend to abstract our world by either interference graph models or sweep under the rug some of the problem, or by realistic SINR-based channel models. Now, if we build a network between those moving vacuum cleaners, we cannot ignore reality, and therefore, we have to be somewhere in the green region. But the point is that there are, and some of us sometimes abstract it and put it somewhere in the white or the orange region, but we have to remember that there are some systems that are really in the white or the orange regions. So there are some systems like WiMAX mesh that are collision-free and we can easily model by an interference graph, and then we can may be able to use some of the results. And as some of you have already said, there is a lot of recent work in the last couple of years about this upper left corner, collision-free interference graph models, mostly based on Tassiolas and Fremides. The time is slotted, the world is nice. There are packets arriving from outside according to some arrival rate, and we want to support the largest possible stability region. And since this is wireless and we can abstract some things, we abstract it by some kind of an interference graph. Under this somewhat simplistic model, there are many possible distributed algorithms that have been proposed. And many people have been trying to understand the trade-offs between how distributed it is, what's the complexity, what's the throughput, what's the delay, and how interference and the topology of the network affect these trade-offs. Sometimes for certain topologies, we can do better. So to conclude, even the wide corner is very difficult. These are anti-complete problems that have to be solved every time slow. We are trying, not only me, many people are trying to move into some kind of a more realistic model of a channel based on SNR constraints. We have some approaches that we think are useful. One of them is based on the result of Jean. I believe that at the end of the day, if we want to go into this green region, realistic world, and so on, we'll find ourselves using heuristics, but this is not a bad thing. Even this single hop now is a heuristic. It's not something that is fully optimal. So, that's fast 7 minutes.
Question, comments?
Just a comment. I think there's one thing you guys are sweeping under the rug so far, and that is whether you have a multi-hop network or a single hop network. And so when I hear you guys say, here's a reality of a scheduled network, you show a single hop. And then the dreams are actually multi-hop. 802.16 is a good example. You're right, the mesh was defined by 802.16, but it is not implemented. The deployments you hear about when you hear about 802.16, it is single hop. And the reason is exactly because of what this panel is addressing, these complexity issues identifying the conflicting links with really being collision free. So
I would say I did want to make a comment on that too, which is the military system that I was alluding to earlier, and I think Gil also mentioned some of them, and John mentioned some of them, were multi-hub, simple but multi-hub systems. And the real issue, and it was swept under the rug actually because I didn't get to it because it was my last slide and I talked for too long, was indeed I was talking single hub and multi-hub. And since the next panel is going to be talking about random access, maybe it would be interesting to hear from the random access people a little bit about multi-hub. There is no question that for the collision-free scheduling people, the work that we're all alluding to was multi-hub work. The practice may be different, I agree with you, but the work that we're all talking about was definitely in the context of multi-hub. So when we talk about the framework of the Tassilo and the scheduling framework, we're certainly thinking multi-hub. In practice, we're not there. It's interesting to hear from the next panel about
what
happened in multi-hub.
He's absolutely right. Okay. In all the works that you cited, okay, everybody cited, yes, the claim is that they do multi-hop, but they absolutely do single-hop because the complexities of multi-hop are swept away. It has proven anything about taking the interference graph seriously, or even how it is computed and how it's communicated and all that stuff. Just assume that way. So once you assume that way, you basically... there's no multi-hop anymore. Second.
I just want to interject. I completely disagree. Does multi-hop problem and the single-hop problem are fundamentally the same?
You will have your time, right? Then you finish, right? Second thing is...
As opposed to your time.
We do not understand in multi-hop. Okay? And I'll give you evidence. We do not understand in multi-hop the effects of topology. Right? One topology type versus another is completely different. There's one central problem in multi-hop. It's how you affect global coordination. To affect global coordination, you have at least partial information on the topology. Recent mathematical results show that just knowing nearest neighbor is not enough. You need to have second-order neighbors. Okay, this comes from second-order effects on graph theory and so on and so forth. If you look at the OLSR, it doesn't even fit that. Okay, for that particular reason. Okay, so the issue is, as far as I'm concerned, is if you want to study multi-hop, there's no way that you can split routing with map, whatever you call it, these layers. But go back to the simple example I gave you for traffic control in LA. You have the avenues, think about it. And try to minimize the traffic. There's a crossroads, right? If you allow random access on the intersection, meaning the traffic light turns red, green, okay, randomly, you tell me what kind of traffic or delay you're going to get. There has to be coordination from one neighborhood to another with the routing and back and forth. So this has to be studied much more so in wireless multi-hop.
And
then
the problem. And with transport of the control of the rate of flow through this junction.
In wireless, if you take care, my claim is, and I'll be a little controversial, if you do MAC and routing well in wireless, the flow control becomes secondary.
I guess you do the flow control of the route, what you mean by doing the
route. Okay. The sort of idea I presented, I think it's going to help. But the price that you pay is queuing delay. We are looking at maximizing flows, right? And we pay a price, which is the queuing. The nodes. So if you want to have minimum delay, you have to synchronize that.
But you didn't answer the delay question.
No, we did not answer the delay question. You can introduce a penalty to try to a penalty on the slack between the arrival date and the service rate. And if you do that, control a little bit of delay, a little bit, right?
Every time you collect information from the network, right, for the purpose of deciding, does it control the area? It's going to cost you delay. The question is the delay tolerable? With respect to the performance of the control algorithms. This is, I happen to be from control theory, and one of the things that I'm trying to push is to the wireless network people is treat the program as it is, a dynamic feedback control system, not just as an open loop where I'm trying to do things and then do something else.
Going back to it, though, I think I'm guilty as charged. My dreams are rather small. I was really talking about, even if you have a single hop, there's serious issues. If you want to do delay optimal scheduling, in that context, then there's a real question about how much control feed, you know, control channel do you need. So you're right that I was actually very small in my view.
Another point, if I now abuse the floor here, is that usually we know time scales. You talk about learning and then acting based on the information. By the time you get information, it may be obsolete, right? So the topology is changing faster than you can change the routing or that you can change the control. So if you take all that into account, maybe in the long-term average sense, you have good throughput, but the stuff in the short-term delay is going to be very bad.
But actually, it's more positive if you like a friendly amendment. If we actually pay attention to the time scales, you will find that these different layers do not all operate within the same time frame. There is a well order, right?
Well,
who's faster?
That comes from the wide network, where you assume that the physical layer is fixed, and I do my routing, and then it's fixed, and then I do my protocol on top of fixed routing. But in a wireless world, the time scales are reversed. The connections may be short compared to the fluctuations of the routing, for example, or the back or of the channel. In that case, this idea that I learned and I adapt is not working.
Well, one caution, right? GTRS has not been very successful. So be very careful as far as, you know, put all your marbles on that, okay? There actually have been monumental failures as far as what how the system is going to work. The other thing is that for multi-hop military networks, you follow the patterns of DARPA, right? You heard about the 3 hops equals 0 theorem. Right? That says if I take the standard Army setup, okay, of using, you know, TCP, OLSR, and then MAC, you get 0, right, throughput after 3 hops, which doesn't take a lot of rocket science to prove. You can do by the level of calculation. The serious comment is this. As a result of the non-functioning of current multi-hop wireless networks, DARPA started, right, a whole set of new programs, either WNN, CDMANN, WAND. The idea was make a $500 cheap radio, right, which has a lot of knobs for cross-layer, and give it to the network guys and say, now design for me a cross-layer technique that is intelligent enough to understand all these problems. They basically told the research community, both academic and industry, start from scratch. But give me a manner that can provably work, because what I have right now is not working.
But the 3 hop equals 0 is not the fault of the scheduling of random access. It's a combination of using a RAID controller like TCP that is unaware of what is happening on this multi-hop network with random access.
But I'm telling you, it's the current Army standard for manner.
Just one comment. No. JTRS is a well-known name. There are, again, other systems. I'm involved in some Israeli consortium where the loops are much shorter between the developer.
I'm just saying that the developer, sometimes the guy using the system,
that's a huge program. No, I'm not building on that program.
I was going to mention JTRS also, but I did some Google searching, and I think the program was just killed or is in some turmoil or something like this.
It's a huge cost per radio. It's some 30,000. But the point is that some of the, call them the Israeli defense contractors, they combine random access and TDMA. TDMA is not killed. That's reality.
So going back to your original question of, you know, what's the difference between multi-hop and single hop? I think one difference that we're bringing out is clearly, you know, in multi-hop it's harder to coordinate because you can't, not all nodes can hear each other. But there's another difference too, I think, going back to your original question of how do you define a collision? Well, in multi-hop, in a single hop network where you have, let's say, a single 802.11 base station, a collision is when the base station or when the node, the destination doesn't hear the message that's intended for it. And in multi-hop network, we can define a collision perhaps in a different way. So if there's a collision at a node that's not intended as the receiver, then maybe we don't care about that. So if we define collision to be at the intended receiver, that could be a different. We would come up with different protocols based on that definition in a multi-hop network than we would in if we just define collision as a node. Any node receives, let's say, two packets on the same in the multi-dimensional point where we divide up that spectrum. So we can define collision perhaps a different way in a multi-hop network.
Into the picture comes
from
triangle.
I'm sorry. It's hard to notice.
He's a single hop. Yes.
So I think basically one of the problems which was I think also struck kind of the graph is that in wireless all links are not equal, right? I mean there are some links that are probably of good quality compared to others that are of bad quality. You may not require retransmissions on the links of good quality, whereas retransmissions are required on the links of bad quality. So I was just wondering if you guys have any perspective on how this might actually affect, what do you mean by collision free scaling? Actually, this is not kind of completely isolated from interference either, right? So if you have a poor quality link, it's more likely to get affected by interference, whereas a good quality of link is more robust.
And actually, that actually almost begs the question that when you start realizing that, I suppose, get Maharaj's question answers on this, because this kind of effect has been observed in the past. Obviously, it leads to unfairness and so on, and particularly in the context of random access. And people come up with mechanisms supposed to remedy that. But in many ways, that would argue for collision-free-based approaches, right?
Because so the question that I'm raising is collision-free here, because if you have actually a poor link where you want to do retransmissions, and you know, there are even slight levels of interference can actually kill your collision-free transmission, then it becomes unclear what a collision-free or a, you know, this.
Yeah, it's true that in a practical setting you will have that problem, but let's say you want to talk on the same bandwidth and you do not have extra dimensions to spare, then the question of who gets it, of course, will be a function of channel quality for all the users. But the collision-free world will assume you have the possibility of actually handling this channel, right?
Even that, you know, computing that possibility requires it knowledge about whether I'm going to interfere with the X, Y.
Sure. But I was trying to emphasize that the dream has some clear definition. I'm not saying it's achievable.
Right.
Now
these issues of computing collision-free schedule actually requires, you know, really strict knowledge about whether I'm going to interfere with anybody, who's I'm going to interfere with.
So we understand that there's no such thing as interference free.
Right.
What does it mean
right.
collision free?
Right. I mean, given the interference and coming up with a schedule that doesn't cause any collision, that's what the collision free scheduling is trying to do. So that requires prior knowledge about interference. Right.
Let me try to mathematically formulate that. We look at it. Suppose that you have a model of the physical layer losses of neighborhood wise. Suppose you had a model of interference losses locally again. Now you can execute service path, constraint service path, given these constraints, and say, I don't want to include any links in the scheduling of links to paths, whereby there's a higher than 85 or 95% probability that I'll be in loss at a rate. So you can now solve this problem in actual polynomial time, and you can find out trade-offs between the prior information you have and what losses you may have, and that may be called collision-free, although I won't call it a set. The problem is, you're never going to have the information that is assumed in this problem in any time that is close to what you need it for, or in any accuracy in any time, even if you have, as we have gone and done, independent control signaling and monitoring channel. So there's I think from our perspective, it's good to understand that in working wireless networks, whether they're single hop or multi-hop, there are some fundamental limitations, both because of the uncertainty of the physical medium and also because of the information needed and the delay and errors that this causes. And my claim is, we don't really have addressed these questions systematically and try to get hold of them.
So it seems like the
focus on collision free, maybe not quite the right focus here. If you're in, say, one of unlicensed bands, and there's random interference, you know, I just don't see how you can guarantee no collisions. I mean, it's just not going to work. What you can focus on is reducing the likelihood of collisions, which is a more practical problem, I think. So, for example, we've done a little bit of work on transmit power control, where you try to pick the transmit powers, not to eliminate collisions, but to reduce the chance of having collisions. And there's a lot of, you know, as you said, you know, there's a cost associated with doing the monitoring and exchanging information. And even then, once you pay that price, the information you have is still pretty noisy. But you can, in fact, make some progress in reducing the likelihood of collisions. And so you end up working within the CSMA framework, but you reduce the likelihood of collisions. And so it's kind of trying to kind of recognize the fact that you don't have control over everything, but you want to reduce the likelihood of collisions.
So taking that one step farther, it might even be that we don't even want to try and reduce the probability of collisions, right? So in CSMA CD, we don't try to avoid collisions, we embrace them, and we just manage whatever happens afterwards. excuse me. So maybe what we want to do is instead allow collisions. And I think maybe the emphasis should instead be on, or maybe the right distinction that we really want to talk about is the difference between random access and scheduled access, where scheduled access is there to give us performance guarantees and random access is there to give us, let's say, optimal performance in some way. And then bringing back your point earlier about, you know, random probabilities of link quality and so on, what that really affects is our ability to give performance guarantees at all. And so does scheduled access give us any benefit at all in the presence of, you know, random links?
So I think that's an interesting, we talk about things that we shut down in the rut. I really think the session should have been called random access versus scheduled access.
Right.
I think that's the right question. But when they gave us the opening of a collision free, then people like me immediately said, oh, what do you mean by collision? And we kind of stuffed the question under the...
You can think this session as the first part of the session, which is random access versus scheduled access.
That's right,
so
that's right.
This next panel is basically the other
access. That's right, so a lot of us, you know, cling to the word collision and the schedule.
I think there's a similar terminological confusion, at least where I'm coming from. I think carrier sense is a beautiful idea, and bridging CSMA under random access brings kind of wrong analogies to mind. Take traffic example, like stop signs and roundabouts, they're not random access, they are carrier sense access. And under certain conditions of neighborhood traffic, they work beautifully. Any other solution is not the one you want over there.
But is that collision free?
No.
What it does, it creates queues which introduce delay in the interest of minimizing the collisions. I mean, there's a trade-off here. But another important issue I want to raise is, okay, we all talk about collision free and this and that and the other. These are metrics that they are in our mind, and then there's two simulations. Do we have an actual set of metrics that we will go out and measure what matters to the user? What does it matter to the users? How much traffic you can get across? When is the network available? Things like that. There has been a movement in the community to get much more systematic. There's a whole community out there to measure wireless internet and define on the basis of these measurements new metrics that we can take in our analysis. Okay? And if you look at it from this context, collision seems to be even more theoretical than you even want to admit.
I don't know. I really think that the concept of collision is undefined, and it's just confusing supply with demand. There is the supply of the channel, that the channel has certain resources and the receiver can decode the packets. The demand can be concurrent. The fact that there is concurrent demand doesn't mean that the receiver side cannot handle this demand. And so I think a lot of work brings this confusion to the extreme and is really associating the fact that there is concurrent demand with something catastrophic that happens on the channel, which is not always the case. And I think it's problematic.
I think it goes back to the comments of Eitan and Karan. It depends on your receiver model. In information theory, there is no such thing as collision. There is a joint capacity region. So you receive some signal that is corrupted by noise, you are still able to receive bits if you have the optimal receiver. So one way in between is the deterministic model of DDJ, right? That says, well, I'm missing the least significant bits, but I'm still getting the most significant bits under the optimum coding. Right? So in information theory, there is no collision. But in practical receivers, maybe there is collision.
And also, I wanted to make a comment about multi-hop. Since it worked so poorly, do we really have to stick with that model, the fact that you have to switch a packet and send it from one point to the other? I think if it had some chance to work, it would have not given zero throughput
there is
after three hops. So perhaps it's just really wrong to think.
So the answer is that flat multi-hop is a dream. If you start introducing hierarchies, then it can work very well.
But then it's cheating. I think whenever you have to introduce hierarchy, you start to be cheating.
He just made an argument to be practical, right? So the idea that you're going to have thousands of users, right, as the army once came, in a flat manner, excuse me, forget it.
All right, but why do we have to be stuck so much with this model? Why is that okay?
No, you're asking the model, are you challenging the model of store and forward networking? Is that
what yeah, the fact that you have to store and then you have to select
so what is
one
the
guy
alternative besides what happened?
Process network. There are all kinds of guys that have your packet.
Cooperative, network coding, the physical layer.
There are, when you have correlated traffic, there are all kinds of other things. Why do you have to forget that this information is held at various points? It's exactly the same information. Why these nodes have to handle it as if this is new
that's
information?
That's not my dream, we made
that. But you will have to do some algorithm.
No, absolutely. You have to shuttle information one point to the other, but that you have to just do it on a node-by-node basis, that's not that clear to me. Mm-hmm. And that you have to view it as a path.
So you're talking about some of the cooperative schemes and so forth?
Yeah, so you can have groups do things together.
Perhaps that goes back to the very formula you just think about in implementing some of these ideas. When you have...
They could be very simple. I mean, you actually, in a way, if you can cooperate, you don't have to schedule.
I think the question goes not back to the overhead, but to cohesiveness of the network. If all of the users in the network are assumed to actually follow a certain structure of the receiver transmitter, you can actually formulate much more interesting and cohesive set of nodes that cooperate in more interesting ways. If you're working in unlicensed band and any device you have bought comes from a different, you know, manufacturer, then the question is, you know, some level of interference you have to accept as unconstructed.
Yeah, of course, you wouldn't have to handle interference, but the question is, among those nodes that are part of your legacy, right, why do you have to envision that only one guy of all the people that heard has to do one specific action and these, I have to set up a path. I could do other things. And if there are multiple nodes that decode the information that comes from several directions, do they really have to choose which one they have to transmit, or can they transmit that jointly? I mean, there are a lot of other things that could be done. So I don't know, maybe.
You're right, but there's an effort to try to rethink the entire thing on a clean slate. Right? Mm-hmm. And that means, though, you have to, and we are pursuing that, some of that, you have to really rethink the entire protocol structure. Forget even the current layer, talk about layer components and things like that, and see what's the best way to combine the network to function. If you just think of the network as a system that its job is to transfer bits from here to here and here to here. So people have looked at things like that, but there is a foreign fundamental physical reality, right? If I want to go from here to 10,000 kilometers, right? And I want to assume under set, I would even be more general, under several power levels, I cannot do the non-pop. So I have to go through several hops, right? So then, on the other hand, many of these atom networks are essentially collaborative in nature. In more than one way. So, and if this is exploited, many of the things we talked about can be done, but this means completely starting from scratch. Rethinking the whole program from the point of view of the system, here it's requirements, you're free, and so on and so forth. Because what happens right now, where at every node, you go up and down the stack, it's proven in experiments in social people in other places that this is very inefficient in terms of time and energy, right? But we don't have an alternative, right? Because that's the structure of the layer, isn't it? And just doing cross-layer in a conventional way, because you put some knobs within the three layers you have, in my opinion, okay, it will give you better results, but not completely the answer. But, in the same breath, I'll tell you, if you try to do any of that, you have an initial amount that will walk as far as how much of that is going to be diminished to anything that is going on in the industry right now, because they don't want things except small things. So, and we don't have a university or a research lab of size to try to go on these wild things. Okay? We have these realities that we have to
if
change.
If you don't change in the face of failure, when do you change? I mean, if this system fails so miserably, when do we have to...
Look, I'll give you a very blunt answer, okay? They can still milk the customers, and they don't care for anything we do or produce, right? Because they have the, I don't want to say the bad word, the people that they pay, you know, whatever they pay, 29 or 30 bucks a month to get this all kinds of services they sell, and they keep milking it. Okay, go talk to Cisco about changing anything in the products. And they come back to me and tell me that there's hope to change anything drastically. I've been there and I've been bruised. Maybe you have better experience. But they don't look for dramatic.
No,
I'm going to ask to the world of play moderator, if I may. I've been a quiet moderator, but I'd like to ask that we proceed a little bit and then we can continue the discussion. But we have two more panelists that have not had a chance to weigh in the discussion. I'd like to hear Mike maybe next.
Okay, so maybe this is a good time to join in. So I'm going to expand the question. And so I want to take, I want to make an analogy between information theory, or on the left side, you can think of this as sort of physical layer comm theory. And then on the right side, queuing theory, or if you like, you can think of it as sort of a network layer perspective. Okay, so let's start small, look at a single link. From an information theory perspective, this link is an additive white Gaussian noise channel. There's a very nice theory of capacity. Here we have symbol by symbol transmission, and capacity optimizes over all ways of coding the symbols. On the other hand, we could think of a link in a completely different way. Let's just think of, instead of a symbol by symbol framework, let's look at a slot by slot framework. And let's just say that the channels are either on or off, and if they're on a slot, then we can transmit one packet, and else we can transmit zero. In this case, also, there's a very well-defined notion of capacity. The capacity is just p packets per time slot. And so you can ask, well, which model is better? And there's no answer to that question. This is obviously a lot more deep math, but this model might be a lot more useful from a network layer perspective. So these are just different models. Let's go further. Let's look, instead of a single link, a multi-user link. So there's a multi-user broadcast capacity region in an information theoretic sense. Again, it optimizes all codings over symbol-by-symbol transmissions. But now, one difference is that this is a capacity region now. It's a vector of achievable data rates, and there's both an achievability proof as well as a converse. Well, let's look at the multi-user setting here. This is where the link-based model gets interesting. Here, there's also a very elegant theory of capacity in this network. So here, we've just got a bunch of these links, on-off links, and the idea is we're doing opportunistic scheduling, or we can select one server to schedule every time slot. And again, there's an achievability proof and a converse that shows the capacity region is given by this set. This is a nice, elegant result by Tassioulis and Ephemerides. So again, a closed form expression for capacity, but two different models. Let's go further. Well, this is where the information theory breaks down. So if we have a multi-hop network, there's no theory of capacity. But on the other hand, the link-based model is going strong. And we see that we again have an exact expression for capacity. It's essentially just given by a set of multi-commodity flows over a set of graph family link constraints, where the idea here is not we're not trying to optimize coding over symbol by symbol transmission, but what we're trying to optimize is scheduling and routing. Let's make it even more complex. Let's make it a time-varying mobile ad hoc network. And again, the information theory doesn't have anything to say in terms of capacity, but here the capacity is again known exactly for any ergodic mobility model. And again, the capacity is optimizing over all possible scheduling and routing. And this also works for general models of interference. It could be interference sets, it could be SINR type models, whatever. It's a known theory of capacity. So how do we actually optimize a system with this link-based model? Well, the basic idea is to use generalized back pressure, generalized max weight matching. So you can describe the data pumping capabilities of the network on a particular link in terms of a function, where this should be C of L. This is just the, C of L is just the rate that link L can transmit. If you take a control action, generally abstractly called I of t, and the topology state is some S of t. So we can take various control actions that would define what we're allowed to do in the network. And again, just general, this could be SINR model, collision-based model, interference set model. This function could be anything. It doesn't have to have convexity or it could be discontinuous as well. So we want to generally maximize, take a control action to maximize this weighted sum of transmission rates, and we know that that's going to achieve at least the link layer notion of capacity. Also, as long as we take any action that tries the best that we can to optimize this, then we're going to do well. If we can optimize this to within a factor gamma, and this is again for a multi-hop network, then we can immediately get within a factor of gamma of the capacity region. This is for any basic function of the network, any way of describing the network with this function. And in fact, you can think of this in a random axis. You don't even, if you maximize the expectation of this to within a constant factor, so think about random access strategies, Aloha protocols, then again, you get within a factor gamma of the capacity region. So the difficulty is, of course, to maximize this weighted function, this is what we want to do, but this is the complexity problem. If you have a really complex network model with all kinds of interference constraints that couple, well, it's just as easy to write down the math problem, but implementing this max weight scheduling is very difficult and in some cases NP-complete. So let me make the analogy direct here. So in information theory, for a point-to-point channel, we have a known capacity expression. Shannon told us that randomized coding achieves the capacity. So what do we need further? We have complexity of randomized coding and the delay of randomized coding is difficult. So what has been the past 30 years of communications theory research? Well, we want to get this answer, so we want to design strategies knowing the answer, but we want to design practical strategies that can actually get close to this answer, which overcome the complexity and the delay challenges. And so, you know, issues like turbo coding and other things have been known experimentally to perform very well and very close to this, even though there's no analytic theory or there's not as much analytic theory of the sort of practical coding strategies. So in the queuing sense, we have exact expression for capacity. We know what it is. And in fact, we know randomized algorithms, including a lot of recent work that's on this list, can achieve the full capacity, and that's including very nice work that Jean presented today. But the problem is a similar problem, so I would state that we're actually in a similar situation that the information theory community was in years ago, whereas we know what the capacity is, we know randomized strategies can achieve the capacity in the same way that Shannon told us randomized coding can achieve, but the complexity and the delay of all of these strategies is the main challenge. And so what we really want to do is design strategies that, in the same way that we have a coding theory for information theory, we want to really have sort of the corresponding coding theory for networks. So here's my final slide, and I have two suggested approaches. One, let's keep this link layer model, and let's try to design good algorithms that work well in practice. We know what the answer is. Let's try to get there. In the same way that turbo codes work, can we think of it in terms of sort of turbo multiple access ways of getting? And in fact, there are recent works that do this and show that you can, in fact, perform very well experimentally, very close to what we know is the optimal, even though you can't prove that it always works because these are NP-complete problems. The second analogy, it touches suggesting is that let's forget about this link layer model, or let's not forget about it entirely, let's expand it so that we're not just thinking about links, but we're thinking beyond links. So this is combining phi-layer concepts and networking, and there is recent work in terms of like network MIMO, cooperative communications, network coding, and I've done some stuff myself on multi-receiver diversity, where we're thinking sort of beyond links so that this is really a broadcast channel that we have. And so these are sort of two approaches, and that concludes my talk.
Giuseppe to be around, but he's not around to defend the information theory.
I have about 15 questions, okay, and I will stay with the more fundamental ones. First of all, we can't really compare, and we have raised this point again and again, right, me and others. We cannot really compare information theory with dynamic networks. Okay? Information theory is static, asymptotic, not time-varying. We have time-varying dynamic systems here. Okay? So you can compare them, but I think some of the conclusions that people draw are wrong. Now, regarding the correlation with IT and ST in particular, okay, if you look at it from a control theory point of view again, okay, you're talking about measurements and states that you need to know in a distributed system. Nobody, to my knowledge, have told me where the information resides, how they're going to get it, how they're going to compute it, what is the complexity of estimating those states based on real measurements, subject to errors, subject to time delays, and what's the effect of that on the maximization of your offer. Unless we solve these problems, right, we cannot get near addressing correctly, as you say, the problem of delay and other measurements, right? But the nature, the real basis for the difficulty is exactly this. We cannot just state we have this state of the network and we base an algorithm on that because that is not achievable, period. So unless people address the question as it should be, as a partially observed system, and understand the cost of estimating the states and the effects of measurements, I'm sorry. There are fundamental limitations we know that they're not going to allow you to address the questions you want to address.
I have to defend information theory just for a moment, which is to say that there are some generalizations that we have that enable us to treat some of the features that you've mentioned. So for example, outage probability, it doesn't solve everything, but it's one way of getting closer to dealing with time variation. Just a point. Carry on.
I'm not.
Okay, so 40 more questions.
Look, okay, I have famous information theorists in my next door, right? And we argue about this day in, day out. And I have been gag orders, okay? There is a fundamental problem, right? Information theory, as you pointed out, does not address delay and complexity, right?
So if I can address. So that's an important question, and that addresses all of these sort of unsolved things, which I'm sort of calling the corresponding coding theory of networks. But it is useful, and I've made some graphs, I don't have them right now, but it is useful to compare sort of the optimal that you can get in a centralized fashion with idealized assumptions and complete scheduling. And then, I mentioned you try to maximize that weighted sum. Now try an ad hoc way of maximizing that weighted sum and see what you can get. And the graphs are kind of interesting because you can actually see what the best you can do is. And you can see that there's a gap. And in some of the graphs that I've done, there's the gap is on the order of, say, a factor of 2, sometimes factor of 3. You can actually simulate the algorithms. And it's interesting to compare to baseline performance and the performance that you can get in a distributed system.
I'll be the first to argue with you. To say that you this is not a some of these theoretical abstractions are not useful. They are, but I was just trying to point out where, in my opinion, the heart of the matter is.
John, I wanted actually to ask you about this. So you repeated this a few times, and I don't disagree at all that really we should look at it as a control system with the feedback and partially observable and so forth. But and there's been some work along those lines, but not enough clearly. But one of the things when you start looking at the system of controls is that they also come with a whole set of assumptions as well that are equally challengeable, such linearity and the like, right? I mean, oftentimes we linearize the systems and so on. So maybe at another point, maybe during your panel, I'm not sure which panel you are talking in, but maybe you would like to tell us, or you could tell us and share with us some of the approaches that are control-based limitations.
Well, I cannot give you a talk about that, but I'll give you a very simple snippet. DARPA started this program in sort of control-based manner, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
But they're not really doing the kind of things you're talking about in there.
Wait. One of the two groups, the one that was with Lockheed Martin and Nguyen Chang and Kumar and Sasha and those, they didn't really follow the control optimization point of view, right? And with utility and so on and so forth. Then they ended up with some of the problems that you raised, okay? Right. And as you pointed, Michael, I mean, they basically they said, okay, optimally I could do that if I had all information. I cannot do, you know, really in reality packet by packet scheduling, so I had to do all kinds of accommodations. Then there came a nice set of papers that said, how could we realistically approximate what control theory preaches to something that's practical? And out of this came, okay, the Marconi stack that they actually implemented and experimented. And for certain actual real networks of not very large size, it worked. So,
but John, the control-based approach you're taking is precisely the one we're talking about here in this book.
I'm not going to argue.
It's exactly this. I mean, it's not different than it's exactly not a new slide, but it's they are talking about exactly. I mean, if you look at their slides, they're talking about extending Tassiola Sapramidis 92 into reality, and that's those, the Marconi stack is exactly that. So
no,
it's
no,
not
the point is this, right? I'll repeat. When you tell me, all right, that your algorithm is going to use IT and ST, as Michael put them down, okay, that I know, unless you address the question of what is that really? Where does it reside in the network?
Can you define IT and SD? What is that?
IT was the state.
Information theory?
SD was topology. No, in your open panel. I'm using your same
IT.
Symbols.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Oh,
that's
IT.
Why I have
control.
Control
action.
Because, you came to
Maryland
with a long discussion on this issue. Very issue when you came, right? So IT and SD, exactly like you have your equations. Okay, the state of the network and the state topology, right? So, fine. Where does this information lie? How much it takes me to get into who he knows, right? What are the effects of inaccuracy? I think, to me, that's the heart of the matter if you follow this approach. And from what I know, right, and I'll be happy if you prove me wrong, truly, because I do think that there's a convergence here between true communication control, okay, as Kumar and many others said. And show me works that they go systematically against this question. Right? How do I estimate these things in distributed fashion based on real measurements? What is the delay effect? What's the effect of errors and so on and so forth? Because assuming you know them, at least, unless you tell me that you have a very clever algorithm that gives you a pretty good few bit estimate of what I'm knowing, okay, then many of these things, you know, work on assumptions that they are not real, clearly realistic. That's the only point I'm trying to make.
Yeah.
Not that philosophically we disagree. I don't disagree at all. I'm trying to say what, in my opinion, are the central problems.
The future directions for research.
Right. I mean, you need to understand how you go from actual things that every node can monitor to the estimate that the topology state. Okay. What do I need to know? There is a very interesting theoretical problem here, which very few people have addressed. It's called topology compression. Suppose I want to set the minimum amount of information on topology at large, so everybody knows a little bit, so they can do what you want to do. Right? How much do they really want to estimate? Do they need to know just near the neighbors? Do they need to know second-order neighbors? What if they miss five or six of the nodes? What is the effect of the receiver? If you usually hear how many, 9 kilometers out of 14, and you call somebody neighbor, what if you miss it? These are the kind of things that as a control person, right, and I'm not having anything against communicators, I work in both areas. These are the kinds of things I'd like to see studied in the future, right? That's what I'm saying. Now, let me give you a very simple example. You put out there, okay, and I'm not pointing at you, because this is, you didn't do it, because other people put it. You put down the SINR model, okay, based on additive wet Gaussian noise channel. Do you have many examples in real interference channels that the additive Gaussian white noise model is true for wireless? Please.
I don't know.
All right? So, I mean, there are results from Raytheon and from BAE.
Oh, I mean,
for
the
Air Force, okay? Let me give you a positive result.
Channel.
Where they did what Eitan suggested before. They went out and they built very expensive detectors and receivers to find out, what's happening. Because they were trying to do the problem of aircraft-to-aircraft communication. Much simpler problem, not as difficult as you described. But there they were trying to use who's up, who's trying, detect it in very fast time, and allocate accordingly, okay? The statistics that came out of these real measurements were not additive wet Gaussian, okay? And Andy Viterbi will be the first one to show you the back of the envelope calculations in his famous papers that says, multi-user detection reduces the noise from the other receivers, and that can be approximated as wet Gaussian noise. But I think, given the advances in the theory of multi-user detection, it can be a lot better than that. So even the simplest INR model that everybody uses, okay, is a nice abstraction, but it could be improved if we had better measurements, right? That's all. I'm not trying to be, sometimes I talk and people think that I'm very negative, okay? No, you asked me to
No, I think before we move on, I do want to give an
right?
No, I think the important message that I'm getting out of this is that
you know, going beyond going beyond the simple abstractions, looking at some of the realistic constraints, and maybe a control theoretic framework is certainly something that everybody around this table is in agreement on. But I want to give Anil a chance to also present his thoughts.
Yes. So I guess I'm still talking about the dream part, given that you trashed interference and all that stuff. One thing which came up in Mike's talk was in the context of Tassilius Ephraimidis, if we are able to do max weight scheduling efficiently, then one can get a good approximation to the throughput capacity. And like all the most of the results that we put down, they require solving this optimally and so have exponential complexity. And a lot of work, theoretical work, so it's still in the dream part, has made up interference models and tried to find independent sets and things like that on these graphs. Generally felt that even though it's a weak abstraction, the model based on SINR threshold interference threshold is somewhat better than just like a disk model, but that becomes much harder to solve from a complexity viewpoint. And so I'm going to talk about the comparison between these two models and how the disk-based models can actually still be used to in a suitable way to understand the physical model. So so there's the max weight scheduling problem. And so here is again a cartoon of the interference problem. So typically in the disk-based model, based on the power level, we make up a disk, and using that we construct an interference graph. And on the right, this very simplistic SINR-based interference model, a bunch of links can be scheduled simultaneously if the SINR at the receiver is more than some threshold. Again, even this is clearly a big approximation, but in many ways it's probably much more realistic than the disk-based models. And what I want to argue is that so all these, like we already pointed out, these are NP complete, and so we need the polynomial time approximations. The disk-based models, they have this locality, and oftentimes greedy algorithms work well, can get constant factor approximations, and it is inherently local, so there are efficient distributed algorithms with low overhead. But the I refer to this model here as the physical model, even though it has all these approximations. The physical model defined here, natural greedy schemes do not work well. And in general, we don't know constant good approximations. From a theoretical point of view, the performance estimates that you draw from these two models significantly differ. Of course, both of these are approximations. They also depend on things like whether you fix the power levels to be the same in both of them, or you allow power control. And then finally, at least in some cases, you can relate the performance in the physical model to suitable static graph measures, which I'll come to. Here is just an expansion of what I talked about. Even in the disk-based models, if you have like non-uniform power levels, then the simple greedy doesn't work, and one needs like an inductive ordering to get a good approximation. But in the physical model, like I mentioned, just greedy doesn't work. What is known in terms of provable algorithms is only polylog approximation guarantees to the length of to the scheduling complexity, which in turn, using Tassilius Ephraimidis, translates to the throughput capacity. Yeah, so basically the physical interference model still is very open in terms of how to improve the performance guarantees. And so a number of papers have tried greedy heuristics for this SINR-based model, where basically they take a bunch of links and choose some links. If they don't simultaneously satisfy all the SINR constraints, then they pick some links which satisfy some condition and throw them out. And there was a nice paper by Wartenhofer and his group which showed that these schemes don't work well, and their complexity can be in some cases n times the optimum. the what one can infer from these two models, it depends on whether you're doing power control as well. So if power control is also allowed, then the throughput that you can get from the SINR-based model can be arbitrarily larger than what you can infer from the disk-based model. There's a nice paper by Wachnoffer and this group which showed that they can construct instances where the scheduling complexity in the disk-based model is proportional to the number of nodes, whereas by choosing suitable nonlinear power levels in this SNR-based model, one can always get a schedule of length log squared n. And again, if you use linear or uniform power levels, one can't do as well. So the power level choice is important. But on the other hand, if you allow power control, then throughput estimate that you get from the SNR model is always higher than what you get from the disk model. But on the other hand, if you fix the same power levels, which would be a constraint in many settings, then it's not. Then there is no consistent behavior. In some cases, what you can get from the disk model would be higher, and in some cases, what you can get from the SNR-based model would be higher. So it's not a clean picture. So finally, what I want to come to is, so given that these SINR-based models are hard to understand, and they are clearly more realistic, and they're not consistently related to this based model, one question are there some measures which one can come up with which if we design a network which optimizes that measure, then can we say something about the performance with the physical interference model? And there are some results on that. So there is a measure called the row disturbance for a given topology, which using which one can show that the scheduling complexity is related to this row disturbance factor. So what intuitively this quantity measures how many senders are within a particular transmitter. But the problem with this is this could be much larger than the length of the optimum schedule. And so in some recent work, we've extended this based on a technique called inductive scheduling. So instead of looking at all the senders with close to a particular transmitter, if we look at links whose lengths are longer than some threshold, and if we define a graph measure based on that, that can be related to the length of the optimal schedule. So in fact, the C of E that we define, one can show that that's a good lower bound on the length of the optimum schedule, and based on this, one can get a provable bound on the scheduling complexity related to the optimum. Again, there's a nice paper by Wartenhofer where he looks at the scheduling complexity of connectivity for a set of nodes, and there he shows that that can be related to a measure IN of that set of links, which is roughly the number of in links within some distance, and he shows that the scheduling complexity of connectivity is proportional to that quantity. Since we're running out, maybe I'll just summarize by saying that as long as we are still dealing with interference, we still have to solve these problems of max weight link scheduling and scheduling complexity. And it does matter in such a setting what model we use. The physical models are much harder from a computational viewpoint. But in some cases, one can isolate the graph measures, which one can solve separately. And if done correctly, the performance in the physical model will be related to this particular static graph measure. Thanks. Yeah.
So, if I understood it correctly, you're saying that in the physical model, especially if you don't put, if you allow for power control, you can get sort of arbitrarily better performance than you might think of from the disk model.
Right.
But I always wonder if that's because you're allowing, in some sense, unlimited power control, because there's no sort of max power constraint of a node. So in some sense, you're gaining the scheduling complexity at the expense of infinite power.
Right.
As far as I've seen, all of those formulations allow you to really, you know, there's no bound, upper bound in that. Are you aware of results where there's also some trade-off between the power that you need to put into the system and the capacity you get?
Yeah, that's a good point. Let me first say that if you put the unlimited power constraint even in the disk model, you still cannot do better than that. So in that setting, it is true. But in general, if you place some constraints on the total power usage, for instance, there is no provable bound on how different these are.
We've done some work in that area. We're looking at not the theoretical aspects, but the practical aspects. And as far as we can tell, the obvious result holds, which is that the wider your range of allowable powers is, the more you can schedule, so the better the performance of those you get. So there's nothing surprising there. And the other thing you need to be concerned about is that in reality, you know, even though your power control register may have enough bits to represent, let's say, 128 values or something like that, you don't really have 128 different levels. And clearly, the longer your range is in reality, because of, let's say, a passive power control.
Is there any correspondence between having this power control and possibly aligning on the kind of topologies that we know at low complexity give optimal schedules? You know, the kind of network from Gill and
so one problem is that these good solutions in the physical model, they use nonlinear power levels, so they're not proportional to the path loss, for instance. So if you translate that to the directly to a disk model, that would I don't see how that translates.
Because you're in effect controlling the interference constraints that make the problem or the problem.
I'm told one more question. I was about to say the one last question, so I'll let Sean get one
I think one interesting class of models to look at those problems is how the models are kind of differentiated. Deterministic models of channels, where depending on the SINR, you keep certain bits, right? And then you can see the interference with the other nodes that will kill some of your bits. That might be another connection to the capacity.
Yes, John, I just asked you. Let me talk about the following. I use different signals, high power, much smaller duration in time, right, for housekeeping to get some of the information. Different power level than the one I use when I want to transmit. Practice, for instance, like a flash or at the end, there's some that this is very, very useful. In terms of helping with the complexity gap. Have you thought about that at all? Under the topology control you're looking at?
No, not really. I've seen some of this work. I think that's a very promising thing.
Yeah. And the other question I have is, many of the algorithms you described, and many of the others that you've seen in literature, they lead to these problems of optimization, that they can be actually mapped one-to-one to
with these statistical physics problems that come out of spin glasses and stuff like that. There, people have done very interesting heuristics like replica methods and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Have you tried any of those to get bounds?
Many of those statistical physics methods assume something about the distributions of nodes. So in some cases, yeah, there are results on, for instance, random distribution of nodes. One can do much better. In fact, an earlier paper of Agarwal and Kumar, they show for random distributions, any set of links which in the disk model can be scheduled using in the SNR by suitable choices of parameters. So I think with certain assumptions about the distributions, one can improve these significantly.
Before the physicists take over, maybe we should actually move in that direction and do something.
Yeah, that's
can I put one last question? It's kind of coming from a higher layer perspective, so from a media application point of view, which was brought up before. I actually have two questions in this double when this discussion on random access and scheduling. One of them is that many of these applications you talked about, media for example, they tend to be highly dynamic. And I'm curious how you compare this random access versus scheduling from your perspective. I can maybe later in the break tell you how I see it from my perspective, from a higher layer perspective. But I'd be curious, these dynamics of the higher layers at times cannot be beautifully, we lay up all of them with beautiful tuning models, but in reality, very often these applications are driven by other types of physics, so to say, by the source characteristics, for example, what the user wants to do. So how, given these different types of dynamics, at times quite difficult to characterize, how would you compare the random access versus the scheduling? That's one question. What efficiency as well as complexity? And the second, a little bit related question is most of this information about the different receivers have is decentralized and is private to these different users. So there could be a lot of cheating and lying involved, or for some extent, maybe just bad red control mechanisms that could be applied at different schemes. And how do you compare this, again, random access as opposed to scheduling in terms of fairness, if you think about the fact that a lot of the information about the traffic is private. I'd be curious if you have a panel to say about that.
I'd be happy to take
yourself
the first question. I have very little to add to the premise question. But I think that is exactly the holy grail. So even though the traffic is very dynamic, if you overburden the network and work close to the throughput, everybody has to tolerate long delays, then really from a scheduling perspective, you have less randomness in who needs the channel. Right? So I'm sitting at the other end. So that's what I wanted to touch upon when I said we need some basic understanding of what overhead we need and with what delay requirements and what traffic conditions. As you go to less and less traffic, now the sporadic nature of the traffic allows you to do statistical multiplexing, which means that at the scheduler level, I'm dealing with a lot of randomness in the output of these keys. In that case, then there seems to be, you need some notion of common randomness to help you schedule that in a decentralized way, if you're lucky. And if you want to do decentralization, you're going to have to deal with that overhead of really coordinating, and understanding that randomness. So that would be my take, of course. There are many, many other aspects to that problem.
I think given the stress on time, we ran about 10, 15 minutes over. It's okay, because we talked about random access as well.
So,